everybody, you are tuned to Deep Dive, the All Music Books podcast, where we talk to authors of music books, bios, histories, and criticism. I'm your host, Steve J. Today's guest is Edward Allen Fain, who's written two fascinating books on jazz in the White House, which is Ellington in the White House in 1969, and The Best Gig in Town, Jazz Artists at the White House, 1969 to 1974. Welcome, Edward.
Well, thank you very much for the invite.
Definitely. This is a fascinating topic, and it's something different that we haven't covered yet, so I'm excited to get to it. In 1968, President Nixon awarded the Medal of Freedom to Duke Ellington, the first time in U.S. history anyone in jazz had been so honored. That's a pretty amazing resume item for Nixon. How did this happen?
Well, the first thing has to be said is that Nixon was not a jazz fan. The idea from this came from the outside, from people who were familiar with him in his campaign effort to win the presidency in 1968, and of course he took office in 69. Well, let me put it this way. I think it's best to say that the spark for this was really Duke's publicity, long-term publicity man, Joe Morgan, and he talked to some of these Nixon aides probably at the inauguration festivities, and they took the ball. That was Charles McWhorter, and they got Willis Conover involved. Willis Conover was had a jazz program on the VOA, but he also arranged concerts. For example, at the time, he was doing the New Orleans Jazz Fest, which had just got started. Most of my work was done at the College Park Archives, at the National Archives, known as Archives 2. And I plowed through all of the documentation. And so I found the memos that McWhorter had sent to famous aides of Nixon. I don't know if you remember, or your listeners remember, Haldeman and Ehrlichman. Haldeman was a key advisor to Nixon and first said, hey, Duke's got this birthday coming up and on April 29th. Wouldn't it be great if Nixon did this? They brought the idea to Nixon and they need not have worried, because as soon as they brought it up, they said, yes, yes, yes. Nixon was driven by two things. Number one, he saw immediately he put on a big event, and of course he knew who Duke was, all right, no question about it, that this would top anything that JFK had ever done, all right? And, you know, because he's followed the, you know, the Camelot years there and all the splash that they got through the media, et cetera. Immediately, it was Nixon's idea to give the Medal of Freedom to Duke and not anybody else's idea, because JFK had given the Medal of Freedom to Pablo Casals, who was from Puerto Rico. He was an American. So Duke, he was, you know, American through and through. The other reason is one that you might suspect was he had to make amends for the just completed Southern strategy, where he favored in the Southern states white voters over blacks, much to the concern of African Americans, and it was done in code, and it was successful. He garnered all of the electoral vote, so there was this feeling that he could do something that maybe might attract the African American crowd.
A little bit of political gamesmanship and also, you know, sort of self-serving in some ways.
Exactly.
It was quite the honor, but this wasn't Duke's first trip to the White House by any means, was it?
No. It was a long road for him. He tried to get into all the previous administrations, all the way from Harding through FDR, through Truman to Ike, and always got rejected, although he did get a guest invitation by Harry Truman. But as far as performing, and that's what he wanted to do, no. But finally, Lyndon Johnson was the first to open the doors wide to jazz. They had 16 events, and Duke did actually 4 events for LBJ. The first one was important. LBJ had this thing called the Festival of the Arts, where it was a celebration of all the arts, dance and poetry and film and pottery and everything. And Duke held the headlining event on the South Lawn. It was his orchestra appeared in a shell and played things from his most recent suites. And then he got 3 others, one where he was joined with the North Texas Lab Band and Stan Getz, and he more or less sat in with that band. And then the third one was a true East Room type event, and that was for the premiere of Liberia. And it was just a combo from his band. And the other one was a small event where LBJ appointed Duke to the Arts Council. And, you know, they had a ceremony and he got up and he played Satin Doll.
Oh, interesting.
Actually, he got four other invites, but he couldn't make the events. So eight events where he performed at four.
Do you know what was Ellington's impression and his band's impression, perhaps, of the Nixon White House and playing this event?
What we learn of these things are not prior to the event, but after. So, for example, some quotes here. Ellington, at the close of the event, and he's going in a limo back to his hotel.
Mm-hmm.
He told his publicist, Joe Morgan, this is a quote here, "With how much more respect can one civilized person treat another than the president in honoring me and acknowledging me and my reason for being, my greatest honor."
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Hank Jones, the pianist. He said, "This man has contributed so much. He has an endless flow of ideas and maintained his musical integrity. More than that, he created a climate of change by taking his music and make it the common denominator. If you can exchange ideas musically, then you can change ideas politically, socially, and so on."
Hmm.
Joe Williams said, "Duke's contribution to the music of the world will last for centuries, and here we are in the White House. I think by recognizing Duke Ellington, the president also recognizes the proud heritage and the contributions of black people to America and the world." Well, in the case of Duke, the most respected jazz musician and most prolific and for over four decades, it was as if Nixon was awarding the Medal of Freedom, not just to Duke, but really to jazz itself, and taken from that point to the African-American. So there was not as much concern as you might imagine of his recent policies.
So they were appropriately honored.
Right.
You know, it's a bit confusing because at best Nixon had kind of a spotty record on the civil rights movement.
Right.
And, you know, famously Stevie Wonder's "You Haven't Done Nothing" was aimed squarely at the shortcomings and implored Nixon to do the work. Any idea what would it have meant for them to refuse to play the White House if they had thought that it warranted that?
The only one who was unhappy about the invite, he went, okay, but he despised Nixon's policies, and that was the guitarist Jim Hall, who went to play, okay. However, he got his revenge, so to speak, later after when the All-Star Concert, which was 90 minutes long, 27 Ellington tunes, Nixon wanted to put it on record. Everybody agreed except him and Paul Desmond because he thought his solo of Chelsea Bridge was crap. It wasn't. But for the case of Jim Hall, he despised Nixon's policies, so he did not approve that music getting out to the public until 2001, after Paul Desmond passed and twisted his arms, "Please, please let us put this music out." And finally, in 2002, the music for this event was put out by Blue Note Records on an album called All-Star White House Tribute to Duke Ellington.
Yeah, I just looked that up and listened to that the other night. It's an impressive array of jazz musicians. And they were assembled to play Duke's tunes. Can you tell us who and how this was assembled?
When Nixon approved the event, he also approved of Willis Conover to be the producer. Conover lived in New York. As you probably know, when these artists go to the White House, none of them are paid. What the White House will generally do is maybe pay for the taxi or limousine to take them to the White House, and also in an event that takes him into the night for the hotel. So the concern would be, of course, is that the musicians had to pay their own way.
Wow.
Take a flight down to Washington.
Mm.
So many of these guys worked in the environs of New York City, many even on some of those show bands, on television show bands.
Mm-hmm.
There were 15 musicians overall. The rhythm section had Jim Hall on guitar, Hank Jones on piano, Milt Hinton on bass, and Louis Belson on drums. The front line, two trumpets, Bill Berry and Clark Terry. The two saxophones were Paul Desmond and Jerry Mulligan. Two trombonists was Irby Green and J.J. Johnson. And then they had three guest pianists for the band to take a break because it was a long concert. The guest pianists were Billy Taylor, Dave Brubeck, and Earl Father Hines.
Mm.
Two singers, Joe Williams and Mary Mayo. This group, the All-Star Band, put on a 90-minute concert playing 27 different Ellington tunes. This represents the largest section of my book. I give a little bio on each one of these musicians I mentioned.
Well, let's go with Jim Hall, because I know him from playing with Bill Evans, and you mentioned him, and I find it intriguing that he was the one who wasn't happy.
Right. Jim Hall.
Let me ask you a quick question while you're doing that. Did Ellington lead or conduct the band, or was he sitting there watching them with everyone else?
He was, like everybody else, listening to the thing. It was a tribute to him. Now, he was pulled up at the very end to contribute a solo, which he called Pat, for the First Lady, which is something he had improvised the afternoon of his arrival at the White House. But otherwise, he was listening. He dug it a lot, especially when people went in and did things, some unusual things with his well-known songs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's Jim Hall. It's a short one. Jazz guitarist Jim Hall's technique has been called subtle, his sound mellow, and his compositions understated. His name would appear on any top 10 jazz guitar list that could possibly be assembled. He came to the fore in two of the fabled West Coast chamber groups of the 1950s, the Chico Hamilton Quintet and the Jimmy Giuffre Three. He next appeared on The Bridge, that's an RCA Victor album, where his classic guitar runs perfectly meshed with Sonny Rollins' fiery tenor saxophone solos. In the 1960s, Hall collaborated with trumpeter Art Farmer and alto saxophonist Paul Desmond before he eventually formed his own trio in 65, which became a mainstay of his performing and recording career. His influence on the current crop of jazz guitarists, Bill Frisell and Pat Metheny, for example, is said to be immense. So that's a sample of a bio in the book. And if you have a favorite song that was played at the concert, an Ellington tune?
Well, you know what? I had an Ellington tune played for my first dance at my wedding, and that was Prelude to a Kiss. So why don't we go with that?
Okay, Prelude to a Kiss. It was played twice. Jerry Mulligan had an instrumental version, which he arranged, which was very West Coast-ish, and to the point where Duke wasn't even sure that it was his song, and expressed concern until he finally halfway through recognized they were playing Prelude. But then Conover also decided to give it a conventional representation, and here he had Mario Mayo sing it, and with the rhythm section backing her. Conover programmed Prelude twice. Instead, he could have chosen Solitude, which is similar in renown, mood, and difficulty, but for some reason he chose not to. Guests who attended the dinner at least got to hear the U.S. Army Strolling Strings play Solitude. Perhaps Conover, like song historian Wilson Fred Sheed, who would vote Prelude the most beautiful song ever written, except for the one problem with the words. Or perhaps session singer Mayo was simply more comfortable in the song. She certainly navigated its tricky melodic waters with ease. More likely, Conover believed that after Mulligan's earlier median tempo impressionistic sketch, the audience deserved a customer reading of the ordinarily dreamy ballad, and she got appropriate applause. And I don't think he would have played Mulligan's version at your wedding.
No. Yeah, I certainly couldn't have danced to a bop version of that. You know, it's interesting because those sections of your book, I think, would appeal to hardcore jazz fans because you get the short bios and then the interpretation of the songs, but also for people who are just kind of getting into jazz, and Duke is kind of a natural entry point. I think anybody right. would find that a very interesting thing.
Right. And another thing I should mention here, and you didn't get an example of it here with the Mary Mayo one, but the crowd reaction, and the reason why I know that is at the archives, College Park archives, that Nixon had all of his jazz events taped by the White House Communications Agency. So basically what I did is transcribed everything on that tape so that you get songs sung, the dialogue between the president or whatever the musicians happen to say, and Lillis Conover's talk between numbers, as well as the crowd reaction. In some cases, it was really crazy. The crowd reaction, by the way, does not appear on the Blue Note CD,
right,
which is sort of a shame in a way.
Yep.
A big, big part of that whole thing, as you know.
Well, I'll also give some props here to Nixon, because he sang Happy Birthday to Ellington at the end of the concert?
Well, no, actually, it was the first thing. It was after the banquet, and all the other guests who were held below in the bottom floor, I call the entertainment-only guests, all got settled into the East Room, and the total crowd in there, including everybody, was about 203 people. The first thing that happened was the ceremony where Nixon read the Presidential Medal of Freedom citation, And then Duke followed with a little speech of his own. Oh, well, he gave Duke his famous four-kiss reward, one for each cheek, as you know, which was appeared in numerous newspapers around the world the next day. He then just walked over to the piano, and the East Room crowd got a little antsy, what's going on here? And then Nixon announced, he said, well, it's Duke Ellington's birthday. He's ageless, but if you all stand and sing happy birthday, we would appreciate it. And he went over to the piano and pounded out happy birthday. And the thing that interests me about it is when they got to the dear part, everybody automatically said, dear Edward, and not dear Duke.
Mm.
That was a Nixon touch. I mean, nobody else. That wasn't planned.
Right. That's a Nixon, like you mentioned, that the public really hadn't seen. I believe, isn't that video of him singing Happy Birthday? I think that's available on YouTube and things like that, isn't it?
Well, two things to mention here. One, Nixon had, for the first time ever in White House history, had the networks, CBS and ABC, tape the show for showing on television the next day, okay? That was the first time that that was ever done. And in addition, he had the USIA, United States Information Agency, make a 17-minute documentary, which was shown to millions of people around the world, well, tens of millions. The guy, the producer, who told me he was told it for hundreds of millions. But given that it was the USIA, the rules are, just like for the Voice of America, you can't show those things in the United States, considered propaganda. For many, many years, nobody could see it. Now, but finally, about 5 years ago, I think it was, the Nixon Foundation put it up on YouTube, which stayed for about a year. And then the year of when Frank Sinatra got, it was his 100th birthday, they decided to put up a film on his event here. Sinatra family said, cease and desist, take it down. And at that point, they got scared and they took the Ellington down.
Wow.
Now, I understand that every once in a while, YouTube, as you know, anything can get up there.
Right.
That documentary every once in a while shows up there, and there are smaller clips that just show segments of it, like you say, Nixon playing the piano, happy birthday, and some other things can show.
Like any proper jazz event, there was a post-party, which had an equally impressive roster of musicians, including Dizzy Gillespie and Willie the Lion Smith. I mean, this sounds like the hippest party in the history of all White Houses. What was that scene like?
Right. At the post-party, you know, in addition to Dizzy and Willie the Lion Smith, there was Leonard Garment, who played the clarinet so that Benny Goodman couldn't. He was a guest there. And Billy Eckstein. Well, one of the greater things is Billy Eckstein and Lou Rawls and Joe Williams all got together to sing the blues on the microphone.
Wow.
And from the USI documentary, there are segments so you can see that there was a cluster of people all around the piano listening to Duke and Willie the Lion Smith and George Wein, Newport Jazz Festival officer, who was a guest, and Leonard Feather, he was a jazz critic, Billy Taylor, every single pianist there. Yeah. And one of my favorite stories is that Marion McPartland was a guest also, but in a very strange way. She had a gig at Blues Alley. It's a jazz place in nearby Georgetown. The White House provided a limo that whisked her over to the White House so she could see part of that all-star concert, then whisked her back to Blue Alley to do her second set, and then after that, back to the jam session. So she got there in time and talked to Duke and also wanted to play the piano. So Duke went over and got Willie the Lion Smith to give up his spot so she could play. She played a couple tunes. She was whisked back to the Blues Alley and told everybody, and she was a little late for her final gig and said, sorry I'm late, but tonight I'm doubling at the White House. And one of the coolest statements any musician ever got to say, right?
Definitely. Do you know if anyone from the White House or the administration stuck around for the after party?
I know of, say, 22 of the 48, let's say, and they were the instigators there, Willis Conover, Leonard Garment, Charles McWhorter, and then Frank Shakespeare, who was the head of the USIA, Vice President Agnew, who, by the way, is a pianist and a much better one than Nixon, and he played Ellington tunes in the lobby while the jam session was going on.
Wow.
And Smithsonian head Dylan Ripley, Protocol Chief M.O. Busbecker, Assistant to the President Daniel Moynihan, and Henry Kissinger, and his secretary Rosemary Woods, who danced up a storm. And the last one is an interesting pick by Nixon. Ernest Pettenaud, who was the maitre d' at the House of Representatives, who Nixon knew back when he was a representative, you know, in the 50s.
You have some great quotes in your book that the press got from musicians and other people who were there. A couple of my favorites was Irv Kupcinet from the Chicago Times, who called it Woodstock in black tie.
And then right.
On the other side of that, there's a butler from the White House who said, the White House sure had lots of soul tonight.
Right, right. And here's a couple of my favorites. Oh, the Earl Hein one, did I mention that?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, he said, I've often wondered why this country didn't give him the same recognition he received many years ago in Europe. It's so late for this honor, although I'm happy that our country has finally caught up. I'm thrilled to be on this program to honor this great man with so many outstanding musicians to help celebrate his great birthday. All he needs now is his own TV show. One of the reasons this was a swinging party is that more than half of the people there were Ellington picks. This would never have happened that way if this event had occurred, say, a year after, okay, where Nixon and company were always concerned that everybody in that audience were supporters, so they could thank them for their past support and encourage them for the future. But at the early on, he told Luke, hey, give me a list of people you'd like to see invited. And there was 100 names there, and about 80 of them showed up. So the point is, the reason why this is such a swinging affair is because the people who were invited down to entertain the party turned out to be the party itself.
Of course.
The New York Times, about 2 years later, said, the party for Duke Ellington last year was one of the gayest White House evenings in years. Those who brought it to life, however, weren't the Nixons or other administration people, but out-of-towners who'd come to Washington especially for the party, specifically Ellington's freewheeling friends from the world of jazz.
Very cool.
One other quick one. I actually put it on the back of the book. It was by the wife of critic Whitney Belliott, and she said, I couldn't believe the combination of characters and the warmth and camaraderie of the evening, all because of Ellington's music. The artists were at ease because they were at ease everywhere they went. They just happened to be at the White House. They hugged and embraced, and the evening was filled with some smiles.
We're speaking with Edward Allen Fain, who wrote two books on jazz at the White House. One is Ellington in the White House, 1969, which we've been talking about. And the second one was The Best Gig in Town, Jazz Artists at the White House in 1969 to 1974. So that Nixon held 13 concerts, was it, during that time period?
That's right, 13 concerts all told, including the Duke one. Was there an overall strategy to invite all of these people, especially since on the night of the Ellington event, he turned to Leonard Garman, he said, if this is jazz, we should have more of it at the White House.
Classic. And who were some of the ones after the Ellington performances?
In order, right after Duke, the first one was Henry Mancini. Nixon had planned a tribute dinner for the moon-circling astronauts, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's who you invite to celebrate their achievement, of course you have to invite the composer of Moon River. The next one is an interesting one. This one has a political touch, in that he invited Al Hurt, trumpeter Al Hurt, Dixieland. The Southern Strategy would be involved there. Interestingly enough, and they didn't know it at the time, it was an historic event. It was the first time that an authentic New Orleans band appeared at the White House. This turn-of-the-century music finally gets there in November of 69. Following that one, Nixon had planned to have a state dinner for the French premier, Pompidou. And Pompidou, since he ostensibly did not speak English, that you have to have a musician, you couldn't have a singer.
Mm.
So they sent out two classical pianists. The event was scheduled for February of 70, and even in December they were sending these things out. Everybody started turning them down. What's going on here? And it just kept up. Finally, only 2 weeks before the event, they panicked and they called the Hollywood and they called the right agent, and it turns out it was Peggy Lee's agent. And she said, yes, her reasoning was, if the president invites you to go to the White House, you go. To her, it was a responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why everybody was turning down the event is that Pompidou had recently sold jets to Muammar Gaddafi of Libya and not to Israel.
Mm-hmm. So there's always politics involved.
Always politics, right. So Peggy gets her event. And then next we have another wild one, which is the world's greatest jazz band. No, they didn't invite them. In actuality, they invited Nicole Williamson, who Nixon had learned about from the British Premier Wilson, who said, Nicole Williams is the greatest Hamlet ever. They arranged to have him come to the White House to read some Shakespeare. But little did they know that Nicole Williams is a wild, crazy guy, and he decided, no, I'm just not going to read Shakespeare. I'll read some poetry and American plays. And since he was an amateur singer, then I'll sing. And for that, he needed a band. And since he hung out in jazz clubs, he picked the world's greatest jazz band. And he didn't tell the Nixon administration he was doing this or had planned this until 2 weeks before the event. They had no choice but to accept what he was going to do. Even at the day before, because it was a big complicated thing, he's going to sing and the band would play some of their songs and stuff. He hadn't arranged for a director or lighting person, and so the White House had to do that in a panic. The next one was Bobby Short. The reason he got his invite is Nixon had planned a little dinner for the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, and Bobby just happened to be their favorite pianist. And then the next one up was somebody you would expect would have been there automatically. There were two prominent jazz people that were Republicans, and that was Pearl Bailey, singer Pearl Bailey, and vibist Lionel Hampton.
Unbeknownst to many people, Nixon was quite the accomplished musician, and he could play piano, an accordion, violin, saxophone, clarinet. He even wrote his own piano concerto, and he played behind Pearl Bailey, didn't he?
He did. Now, she got two events. She did get that first one around of April of 70. She got one in 74, and just quickly, in 74, that was the period of Watergate, and Nixon's administration was sinking along with everything else, and everybody, I don't care what their genre was or their talent, was turning down offers from the White House. So they had a governor's dinner, and you always have to have entertainment, so who could they get but Pearl? So she came in and she did her act. And after she finished, Nixon got up on stage to, you know, do his usual thank you. She asked the audience, wouldn't it be nice to have the president play? And Nixon said, I don't know anything. Well, anything you play, I know. Would you please? It would be history. We all know how you play. It doesn't matter. Would you? Well, he agreed, finally. And he sat down at the piano and played Home on the Range. Pearl joined in, but after her familiar first line, she broke off. Mr. President, Mr. President, wait a minute. I want to say one thing. I want to sing a song, not ride a horse. They just couldn't get together on it whatsoever. And then Nixon broke into doing Wild Irish Rose, and that one didn't work either. And so finally he hit the piano, big opening chords of God Bless America. And then, of course, everybody had to stand up and sing.
Wow.
But the important thing is Nixon as pianist was a guy who could play well off of sheet music, but he couldn't accompany somebody. What he was better at, and this shows up in these events, he was also an actor along with those other things you mentioned. He could always speak without notes, and that showed up well in these events. People have said, have written my book saying, this is a Nixon that I've never known, not the stern, tough guy who would appear on television or strange remarks that would be thrown into the papers. Who is this guy?
Right, right. Well, perhaps most famously in 74, and the photograph graces the cover of this second book, is Frank Sinatra, who played the White House, Nixon's White House. He was obviously a friend of the late President Kennedy as well. How did that come about? Was there a weird factor at all? Or?
Well, the weird factor perhaps is more on Sinatra's side, a little on Nixon's, in that, as we all know, he was buddy-buddy with JFK, two Las Vegas swingers, etc., and he planned a number of grand concerts to raise funds for his election and everything. But after JFK became president, and he had a talk with J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI, he learned of Sinatra's quote-unquote underworld connections. Mm-hmm. And so he cut him off abruptly. And Frank, being a Sicilian, said, well, screw you. I'll become a Republican. Now, he never changed his views. What he changed was his national political identity. But that took time for him to become a Republican. And he worked in California for Reagan, etc. Then when Nixon got elected, he started playing golf with Spiro Agnew, and the White House staffers took note of that, and they were saying, ooh, and there I found memos of this at the archives. Wouldn't that be great if we could swing him over to our side? Their eyes were on him. Sinatra held back a little bit. He wanted to make sure that Nixon would put Agnew on the ticket. He did. And at that time, then all of a sudden, he becomes a bona fide Republican. As far as Nixon is concerned, he's invited to the space shots at Cape Canaveral. Then he was assigned to, for the inauguration, to arrange the stars, the events, the entertainers. And he had a little flap there where he wanted to put a particular comedian on, and he was refused, and so he walked off. And then almost later that night or next day, I'm not sure, he was at a party, and he ran into a nemesis of his, a Post journalist, and had an altercation with her. When he stomped off, he took $2 out of his wallet and stuffed it in her drinking glass, implying that she would lay down for that amount of money with any man around whatsoever.
Yikes.
The Nixon staff, everybody, because this word of this happening got out, and said, yeah, you can't bring him in here for an event. Nixon ignored everything everybody was saying, and then booked Frank for a state dinner event for the prime minister of Italy. While we as a country didn't know the full ramifications of Watergate at that particular time, that is, would be February of 1973, that Nixon certainly did. Mm. And he knew he's going to need all the help he can from anybody to speak up for him. For example, Hollywood stars like Bob Hope and John Wayne were always supportive of Nixon policies. And if he could bring in like Frank and all his friends, et cetera, to speak for him in his upcoming days of trouble, which he knew about that we didn't know that much about. So that perhaps was one reason why he stuck with him. And then the other thing to say here is, here you have a case of the artist, the entertainer, is picked first. Then you go out and you find the dignitary second, i.e. Oh. the premier of Italy.
We're speaking with Edward Allan Fain, who's the author of Ellington in the White House, 1969, and The Best Gig in Town, Jazz Artists at the White House, 69 to 74. I'd like to cut to the present day a little bit more and just get some of your thoughts on that. Some of the presidents to follow would also have musicians at the White House. Willie Nelson and the Allman Brothers, who were significant supporters, playing benefits and such for Jimmy Carter. And Willie famously smoked a joint on the roof to the White House, which he bragged about.
Right. I've often wondered about, were the Secret Service up there on the roof, and did he offer them? I mean, maybe in those days, maybe they didn't have people up there with rifles and everything.
I doubt it if Willie's puffing away.
Right.
But Carter did have jazz acts in as well, didn't he?
The only time we had a real breakout, it would have been in for Carter's famous White House Jazz Festival, it's called, where, of all people, Ornette Coleman and Cecil Taylor were invited, along with the usual match of players. And the interesting comment there on Carter, after he heard Cecil Taylor and Taylor got off the stand, he ran behind the stand and grabbed Taylor. He says, "I've never heard anybody play the piano that way. Does Horowitz know about you?"
President Obama famously hosted In Performance at the White House series, which celebrated Memphis soul, blues, Motowns, and jam sessions, very uniquely American music, such as jazz was, correct?
Yeah, he took a different approach from the majority of presidents, that, sweeping through FDR all the way through Reagan, where you would invite a single artist in to play an hour and a half, or maybe a group, Obama there took a different approach. So like you say, he had a Latin night, he had a jazz night, and a blues night, and a rock night, and a folk night, and a Motown night, et cetera, where he would bring in, 10 or 12 different artists to perform.
Bluegrass star Alison Krauss had a very humble response in performing at the White House, didn't she?
Her remark, and I remember I read this in a paper, what she was thankful for was the recognition of her genre.
Mm.
Just like here, the jazz thing, the recognition of the genre at a time when it was not accepted as fully as an art form. So it doesn't appear, for example, that he had much interest in jazz looking at those performances.
Right.
But I guess inside information, and this was not publicized, Obama would invite the McLean Band Combo over, all jazz players, at various times, for whatever reason.
Well, it's interesting. If Nixon had his moment at the piano, famously Obama had his moment singing Sweet Home Chicago, which was quite a moment.
Oh, is it on YouTube?
Oh, it is. And it's all the musicians who really make sure he gets up on stage. It's and he's into it, you know. It's a very funny,
right. Sweet
moment. How about the current administration? I think, you know, not to get too deep into politics there, but it doesn't seem like there's, you know, kind of a celebration of arts, and in particular American arts there. Who might play there, or
right. Why
not?
Well, I'm almost wanting to say, next question.
That's a pretty perfect answer, because I don't know that there is a proper answer for that. Let's wind it up here, Edward. What do you think the legacy of playing the White House is, both for the artists and perhaps for the presidents as well?
Well, for the presidents, it certainly adds a little sexiness, if you will, to their personas. And also, it can pick up votes. In other words, if you're in New Jersey and you learn that your boy Frank was invited to the White House, aren't you more likely to vote for the president then?
Yes.
The biggest impact is on the artists themselves. It's something to brag about, something to use to reassure their fan base of their worth and their popularity, attract new fans, obtain media interviews and future bookings at clubs and theaters. And if you don't believe this, just take a look at any entertainer's resume. And you will find always, especially if been at the White House, that up top they will say, and such appeared at the White House for President Obama. And of course, in obituaries, always at the top is, and such appear for President Reagan four times. In this country, we don't have knighthood, but the equivalent is a White House event, hopefully with a dinner and a medal, that would substitute for knighthood.
Well, that sounds like a perfect place to leave it. It's a fascinating discussion. We could go on all day, but I'd like to thank you, Edward Allen Fain. If you're interested in his books, Ellington and the White House 1969 and The Best Gig in Town, please check them out. They are fascinating. Thank you, Edward.
And thank you very much.
If you'd like to find out more about his book, please visit allmusicbooks.com. And you can buy it through our site. You can also check out the rest of our deep dive episodes there. I'd like to thank our engineer, Steve Folsom. Finally, a big shout out to Frankie and the Pool Boys for their one-of-a-kind music played throughout this podcast. You can check them out at frankieandthepoolboys.bandcamp.com and on all the major streaming services. Please support your local and independent musicians and writers. We're out until the next time, and thanks again for tuning into Deep Dive, an All Music Books podcast.